Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Software Crafts Podcast. I'm João, your host, and today with us I have Steve Pereira. Steve is a DevOps enthusiast and an expert in software team performance with more than 20 years of experience. His main focus during all of these years has been on using mapping techniques to guide ambitious and struggling teams toward their true north. He's the founder of the consultancy firm Visible, where he coaches teams to boost flow and value using his four key maps of DevOps. Previously, he has been founding CTO of Stat2Flow, building and release engineer and a lifetime workflow automator. He also leads the 6,500 plus, given or taken, member Toronto DevOps community with a regular meetup, events, and annual conference. Being also an agency consultant, finance IT manager, and a tech support phone jockey, he is focused on the flow of value all the time. Welcome, Steve, and thanks for your time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Joe. It's wonderful to be here, and I really have enjoyed our conversation so far, so very much looking forward to this.
Yes, a very interesting off-record conversation. So let's bring it on the record. And to kick off, we have an heuristic that is remove bias and duplication. What is your opinion and experience with this heuristic?
Yeah, it's one that I honestly wasn't familiar with prior to the conversation. And I think it's somewhat challenging. You know, I think certainly on its face, if you look at the sentence itself, obviously seems extremely valuable, right? I mean, bias is very counterproductive, I would say, in almost every case, aside from its efficiency, right? Aside from its the value that it allows us to make very quick decisions, it usually doesn't serve us, and it usually doesn't serve others. And likewise, duplication, I think we find is inherently wasteful. In the context of mapping, I would say that it's very valuable to keep this in mind. It's very valuable to think in terms of collaboration, the value of removing bias and challenging bias by introducing a diverse perspective or a diverse array of perspectives. So having multiple people collaborate on mapping by sharing their perspectives and their understandings is incredibly valuable. And for me, that also factors into removing duplication, because when I think of duplication in the context of mapping and understanding of a current state or topology or an ecosystem or whatever is happening right now, the duplication in my mind speaks to everyone duplicating their own understanding, which tends to be different, right? If you ask 8 people what the biggest bottleneck in their system or their organization is, you will get 8 different answers, almost invariably, right? So that to me is duplication that is not serving the team, the organization, the individual. And removing that duplication so that you have one understanding is extremely powerful. And that's what I find is one of the most valuable outcomes of mapping, certainly collaborative mapping, but any sort of mapping. When you create a map, it means that you have something to share with people. So you can actually present it to others and say, is this correct? From your understanding, does this map look correct? Does it look like I'm representing reality in a way that is valuable and hopefully true, but certainly valuable? And so the act of mapping, even individually, but especially collaboratively, allows us to reconcile all those different perspectives and come into alignment, which is one very powerful aspect of it. I think the most powerful aspect of it is clarity, though, a sense of clarity among different individuals inspires confidence, but also enables action, right? It allows us to make decisions, because really decisions rely on clarity so much. It's so hard to make a bet when you have limited information, especially when in software and architecture and product building, we're constantly making consequential decisions. So the clarity provided by a common map, I think, is incredibly useful.
Thanks for sharing your initial thoughts. And picking up one of these last thoughts, you were talking about bets and strategy and options. And also in my head, I was playing, okay, we have duplication. How about R&D, research and development? Will not be a good place to forget about duplication and let it be?
That's a great question. I think it's fair to allow a certain degree of duplication when it will facilitate the best outcome to arise from perhaps competition, right? So if the way that I interpreted your statement was, in R&D, do we not get the best outcome by having many competing initiatives simultaneously? I mean, certainly we can look at the recent events with COVID and coming up with a vaccine, right? The best outcome is certainly by having as many actors duplicating efforts simultaneously in order to see who can reach the market fastest and incentivizing that, right? Incentivizing the duplication instead of picking one, right? Making a bet on one actor, or saying we don't want to duplicate efforts, so everyone has to collaborate on the same solution. That's also super inefficient, right? So I think in many cases, we get a lot of value by having duplication if the desired outcome is to choose the best result and then focus on that best result. And then maybe you open up competition again and run the same kind of pattern. So certainly it's a fantastic point. I think duplication does have its place for sure.
Yeah, and pops up, I'm starts studying design thinking and the cycles. I'm very fascinated by the diversion and conversion cycles goes to my head when companies try too soon to remove duplication, if they can afford from a resource point of view, from money and time, mm-hmm. can be a fantastic thing, but needs to be managed. And I think that is when mapping plays a role, right? When should we stop and start to converge? So mm-hmm. with your experience, and if you have experiences related to these, what are the signals that you pick up to shut down experiences and start to converge? Or do you have other techniques to go there? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. I think it reminds me of three signals that I really keep track of in almost every situation: complexity, waste, and friction. So to me, complexity is a signal that arises when you start to notice when it's challenging to keep a system in your mind, right? Or to keep a system in a collective understanding, because its complexity has risen and expanded. So once that seems to be causing trouble, you know, it seems that people can't easily grasp it, takes time for people to learn it, or people commonly forget about parts of the system, then it's a convergence opportunity. And it could be, you know, a convergence opportunity that means let's split this up and so that we can focus, so that we can converge our understanding on a smaller locus of focus. And so that to me is the complexity piece that is a strong signal. And it's, you know, I don't know of super technical ways of evaluating it. It commonly comes up with conversations, or where you start to see people take a long time to try and understand something, or it takes a long time to make decisions. That's a fantastic way of measuring complexity. Or people don't feel comfortable making a decision, right? If it's, if it feels uncomfortable to make a decision, it turns out, it seems to me that the complexity is extremely high, and that's something that we could definitely focus on. Waste is, you know, something that you can evaluate in terms of time, in terms of finance, in terms of morale and emotions, right? You can get the sense for when waste is kind of accumulating in a system. Certainly with value stream mapping, that's a fantastic way of identifying waste. But that brings me to friction as well. Friction is one of those things where you can see it by mapping a value stream to a degree, but you probably find out about it much sooner through conversations with people, right? I mean, friction is an intangible thing. It's implicit rather than explicit, but people know it when they feel it. And we have a threshold where different people have different tolerances for friction, but you can certainly discover it by talking to people. And I find it a lot when I'm measuring a value stream, for sure.
And so starting with friction, you said you measure a lot when you are mapping, right? That value stream. You mm-hmm. measure when you are doing the workshops and people have different mental models and the friction arises, or it's more when you are measuring lead times and other details of the value stream? How do you...
That's a fantastic question. Yeah, it is both. It's absolutely both. You know, the friction, you can feel it, you can see it when inside of a workshop you have a team that should be working together that has very different ideas about what is going on. Also, varying degrees of participation. Like in some cases, some people are totally checked out of the exercise because they're not used to participating or seeing value in participation. So that I see as another form of friction, right? It's kind of like you're dragging people along in some cases, almost literally. And so I think that's very tangible. And the idea that people voicing their opinions or their perspective, that can be met with friction as well, where some people will just disagree with interpretations that aren't their own or that don't fit a model that they've understood or this is the way we've always done things is a fantastic source of friction. The status quo, right, and inertia are fantastic sources of friction. So it can definitely manifest itself all over the place. And I think it's a sense that you develop, right? You can become very sensitive to it if you know what to look for. If you know, it's almost like when I think of it in the context of a value stream, any time that we are not creating value is usually due to friction, right? It's usually due to something constraining our ability to deliver value or create value. And so it's all over the place, right? There's never a lack of friction, but where it's most prevalent and where it is having the greatest impact, I think, is the challenge to address.
Indeed. I even can say that sometimes... Well, in our work as consultants, sometimes we don't have the opportunity to do that. It's just to unravel the friction. But as a manager, sometimes you want to push friction because you might want innovation or you might want radical ideas or you might are looking to the system to say, well, I need to split it. Where is the friction? Which led me to your first signal, complexity, that I also study complexity theory, but from a Knevin point of view, which mm-hmm. also is very, very interesting. But you were referring to cognitive load, right? When I cannot have all the parts of the system. And I think that is the work in team topology is amazing because it's one of those works that bring this to the forefront, right? Okay, we need to look mm-hmm. at cognitive load. And you were saying that you figured out tools to do that. What I experienced in the past, but takes lots of time, is to analyze the trends. If, for instance, lead time keep increasing across time from a DevOps point of view, that might seems that we have lots of complexity or not enough skills or. So this is what I did in the past. I don't know what you used to analyze this type of complexity.
Yeah, I think that it is challenging to pull signaling out of trends, certainly because, you know, these are highly complex environments that we operate under. We have to consider things like seasonality. In a team, you can get very different metrics depending on what time of year it is. Whether, you know, someone is training somebody new, you could have your highest performer trying to onboard a new member of the team, and that could drop your ability to respond to incidents or to deliver at your optimal velocity. And so it is hard to consider all the factors that go into evaluating something like lead time and how it's trending over time and how it should trend. So I think we don't really have easy answers for these things yet, but the future of things like value stream management and flow management, the amount of data that we're able to outsource to a system to evaluate and consider multiple inputs that can be distilled to high quality signal, we are just beginning. You know, I think that people talk about AI ops and, you know, the future of signal to noise filtering and insight management. We have a long way to go. I think a lot of that stuff is premature. I think we have yet to even understand the basics. We've only recently got four metrics out of DORA that are incredibly valuable and incredibly important to track. The number of organizations that are tracking any of those is so small that in some cases, you know, we're putting the cart before the horse to go and say that AI can now evaluate your entire software delivery lifecycle and tell you anything very useful. Because all of these things truly require a mindset that will allow you to act on any of these insights, right? So we need conceptual models. We need understanding of flow. We need understanding of value in order to do anything with all these signals, for one thing, but to map the signals to behaviors or decisions and specific actions is, I think, the challenge for right now. And focusing on, you know, as few moving parts as you possibly can, which is the complexity and cognitive load piece, is like, we have to narrow the domain that we need to be paying attention to as much as possible so that there's as few factors contributing to the noise as possible.
Lots of ideas to pop up. So when you say narrow domain, it's the components that a team creates, or it's where we focus as an organization, where we have our agency, our North Star, to use your bio on this? Which one?
I think it's both. You know, I think they're both incredibly important. You know, clarity of desired outcome, you know, the North Star is paramount, right? Whatever comes from the tip of the spear of the organization is going to, more than any other factor, inform the decisions of the organization throughout, right? For, you know, people who are operating in the legal department, people who are operating in marketing, all of that really needs to be driving in the same direction, or else you have massive inefficiency at best. And in a team context, I think that, you know, the tight, we've seen many, many examples of success means the smallest team that can manage to produce value is optimal, provided, you know, you're managing for isolation and duplication, right? So the smaller you can make the bounded context of what a team is responsible for and the domain that they need to understand, while allowing them to leverage the resources of the organization, right? In terms of platform, in terms of hiring talent, in terms of the ability to get valuable information from other teams, that I think is a winning combination. So the smaller the domain that a team needs to really worry about and focus on, I think that's a recipe for managing cognitive load that's incredibly important to consider and design around.
And just because I also came from domain-driven design community, and we have the heuristic making implicit explicit when you are talking about domains, it's from a domain-driven design point of view.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Cool. Yeah.
Because even now there is a big discussion, what is problem space and solution space, because different communities have different perspectives, which is very interesting. Just want to make this explicit. So thanks for that. You also mentioned value stream management, which is kind of new to me. I need to admit I did some value stream mapping in the past, not as the level that you are used to do. But value stream management, it's new. And I was thinking, because you were talking about agents and behavior, this is trying to model agents' behavior. Did I miss the point, or is something else or something in between?
It's a great question. The primary focus I see of value stream management is in modeling the flow of work through the system. So value stream management in a manufacturing context would be the site foreman evaluating the flow of the product through the factory from the raw material inputs to the customer delivered outputs, and being able to track the performance of all those activities throughout the value stream. And I think it really is the difference between mapping and management is essentially that mapping is a discovery exercise that can also lead to innovation. Management is a monitoring, very much a management activity, right? I mean, it's meant to be inspecting flow and inspecting the performance of the value stream, which is extremely important. The one caveat that I would layer on top of anyone interested in management is that just like anything that you seek to manage, if you don't understand it first before you're trying to track its performance or measure it, then you're going to have, I would say, very poor results, right? I mean, your odds of success are very low if you don't understand what it looks like before you try and manage it, because it doesn't really come with an explicit understanding of the value stream. The paradigm is you will implement a tool that plugs into all kinds of areas of your value stream, of your application life cycle. We used to call this ALM, and now it's, you know, it's not ALM anymore, but it's existed for a very long time. The thing that I think has always been missing is this foundational understanding of the value stream as the core unit of operation of every organization, right? Once you understand value stream thinking and seeing work in terms of value streams, management becomes useful, whether it's value stream management or application lifecycle management. To manage anything, you have to understand it first. You have to understand its its behaviors and its purpose. What makes for a valuable and high performing value stream versus a wasteful or low performing value stream. Then you can manage because you'll know what you're seeing when you look at it. And you'll also know that you're seeing an accurate picture. I think that a lot of value stream management is bounded by arbitrary context. It usually starts at code commit and it ends at something is in production. But the value stream itself starts from a customer desire in many cases, right? Or some raw input, whether it's the CEO's idea or something that comes from, an acquisition of some kind. There's all kinds of triggers, but to really operate inside of a value stream context, you need the full picture from end to end, because the opportunities are not usually in the narrow, highly automated software development boundary that we commonly focus on in the DevOps world.
Very, very interesting and a very deep answer. So I also challenge the audience to engage with you on social media to get with the nuts and bolts here. And now I also understand a bit more what you mean with that. And I see where we are going. And let's see how we do that. And now just getting back perhaps to almost the beginning. We discuss value a lot of time, so I'm now really interested, how do you define value or how you help customers to define value? Because when I have this conversation, it usually tends to go to money. I want to do more money, mm-hmm. but there is more than that. How do you do that? What is your experience?
It's a fascinating topic, and I think that it's far from having very clear and concise boundaries that are easily understood. But there are a few things that I keep in mind that help me communicate with people and help me understand it myself. One is that I tend to see value from three perspectives. From an organization perspective, so what's valuable to the organization? What is valuable to employees or contributors, because they have a separate understanding of what's valuable. And for instance, you might not think that something that's valuable to the individual would be different than what's valuable to the organization, but individuals value progress, learning, right? Autonomy, mastery. All of those are individual that the organization doesn't necessarily care about. I mean, they care about the outcomes. They care that those things are being fulfilled, but the organization has a different definition of value, and they should. You know, I think that having these different perspectives is important. The last one, and arguably the most important, is customer value, right? That's the reason that the business is in business. So I think separating our understandings into those three areas really helps define, because at least you have some boundary to work under, and they are different enough that it can help you truly ask good questions about what does value mean in this context. Because if you come up with a definition of value that's outside of those three or not bounded by any kind of bucket or container, then all of a sudden it's open to a challenge, right? It's like, well, wait a second. What does that mean for the organization? What does that mean for me as a contributor? So acknowledging that those things are separate and they can be separate and contribute to a valuable outcome, I think starts you off on the right foot. There's also some really good research from Bain, actually. Bain, the big consulting company, they have something called the B2B elements of value and the B2C elements of value. I can send you a link to include in show notes or something, but there's many, many, many elements of value. And in these two contexts of B2B and B2C, they've broken them out into things like For instance, the ability to, off the top of my head, I have very few of these floating around. Things like increased autonomy, or learning a new capability, enabling you to practice something. These are elements of value that we don't often think about, but given a list, we certainly know what we don't find valuable or what we don't think our customers will find valuable. And so we can go through the list and say, okay, well, this feature that we're developing or this effort that we are embarking on, it is aimed at satisfying or fulfilling or creating this type of value. And that helps. That definitely helps people have really valuable conversations about value, to say, you know, we don't necessarily know what this is, but if we go through a list, we know what it's not, and we can move in a direction of understanding by defining things with that increasing clarity from a nebulous cloud of if value could be anything. If you run through a list that you know, very, very smart people have compiled over many years of experience, you know, I really think that's incredibly useful, and it leads to really fantastic conversations, whether it's a product team is trying to create value, or, you know, an internal platform team that's trying to facilitate internal value to stakeholders or teams that they're, you know, they're trying to provide a service for.
Thanks for this advice and these, you know, practices. And also a thing that I must say is that with the guests in this show, I'm seeing a pattern that lots of them suggest lists as tools in different contexts. So this is emerging, which is fantastic. And yeah, we're going to make sure that the resources are in the show notes in description for people to continue, because all of these type of resources are very useful in people's journeys. And because we are getting towards the end of the show, and because we also want to deliver more value to our audience, what are the other resources that you recommend? Books or podcasts, blog posts?
That's a great question. In terms of value streams, I'm working on a book right now that hopefully folks can sign up for to keep track of, because it should be out by second quarter of this year, focused entirely on value stream mapping, because there's not a dedicated resource that looks at value stream mapping in a knowledge work context exclusively. There's a lot of resources that are anchored in traditional manufacturing and the physical world. So things like healthcare, which are super valuable. Like Value Stream Mapping by Karen Martin is the sort of the de facto standard for value stream mapping in a book, and it's fantastic. But I would say, you know, very high percentage of the content in that book is not speaking to software. And I think that there is a case study that is focused on software, but it's, you know, it's challenging to read through an entire book that is based on physical operating models and value streams when you are focused on knowledge work and you're focused on the friction and complexity and waste that happens in knowledge work specifically. So that's the focus of the book that I'm working on. In the meantime, I've got some resources on my site that I'll link to. There is a great ebook that was put out by Jeff Kies from Plutora that I'll also link to, that goes over value stream mapping in the context of management, in the context of software development and delivery, which I really like. I think, you know, we're in relatively early days of value stream thinking, specifically for knowledge work and the next generation of value delivery that we're embarking on. But it's moving really quickly. There's a lot of really excellent progress being made there and a lot of people talking about it now. So it's an exciting time.
Definitely, it is a time to be alive, this space, definitely. And thanks for your resources. We will make sure that are in description. Also, your social media link, so people can engage directly with you to continue this conversation. And once again, I want to thank you for your time to be with us and have time to record this episode.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff, and you're a fantastic partner for the conversation. It was really enjoyable.
Thanks. Thanks very much. You can follow us on Twitter at SCRAS Podcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn. Hope to see you next week.